So it's my pleasure to give this seminar at Perimeter. I'd like to be there, but it was not possible this time. So anyway, I'd like to thank Wan Yang and the whole group for having me. Today, I'll be talking about the fate of the light ring instability. And this is based on this fairly recent preprint, 2207-13713. That's with Pedro Cunha, Eugene Radu, and Nico Sanchez-Wall. Okay, let me see if this works. You should see a transition now. Okay, so my plan is to start with some background observations concerning the black hole hypothesis. And that is that dark astrophysical compact objects are well described by the black hole solutions of general relativity or some generalization thereof. I will then introduce a technique based on the concept of topological charge and show you as an application that black holes under some generic conditions always have light rings. Then I'll consider the speculative idea that some or all of the dark astrophysical compact objects are horizonless, ruled by some yet unestablished physics, which I shall call the exotic compact object or echo hypothesis. And then applying the technique of the topological charge, I will argue that for echoes with a plausible formation mechanism, if they become sufficiently compact to have a light ring as to imitate some of the strong gravity phenomenology of black holes, they must have a second one, which is fully stable, unless the null energy condition is violated. Stable light rings have been argued to trigger a space-time instability, and I'll use then a concrete echo model to test its fate, arguing it is there and that it can be efficient in destroying echoes. And then I'll close with a discussion on the strengths and caveats of this analysis. Okay, so let me start with some generalities about this black hole hypothesis, together with comments on light rings. Now, the black hole hypothesis is, of course, supported by theory and by observations. And let me do a lightning review of the observational evidence that you all know about. The earliest evidence comes from the discovery of radio galaxies like Cygnus A in the 1930s, AGNs, and the discovery of that quasars are extragalactic objects in the 1960s. The rationale, my son just arrived. So the rationale is that black holes are extremely efficient at converting gravitational potential energy into radiation, which explains the large luminosities involved in these observations by invoking supermassive black holes. Another piece of evidence comes from X-ray sources interpreted as binaries. Whence X-ray radiation comes from matter, which is being accreted and accelerated from a star towards an unseen companion around which forms an accretion disk. The unseen companion must be very compact, and it is interpreted as a stellar mass black hole. The first and most famous such source is Cygnus X1, found in the 1960s. Another piece of evidence comes from monitoring individual stars at the center of the Milky Way, where there's a compact radio source called Sagittarius A star. The star with the closest periastron to Sagittarius star is called S2. Its orbit shows there's a compact object with about 4 million solar masses, which is interpreted as a supermassive black hole. And of course, for these observations, as you know, half of the 2020 Nobel Physics Prize was awarded to Andrea Ghez and Reinhard Genzel. And I should probably apologize to Roger Penrose for cutting him off there. Another piece of evidence comes from the observation of gravitational wave transients by the LIGO-Virgo and Alcagra collaboration. Of the 90 detections, most are interpreted as black hole mergers, and they seem to comply with the expectations of general relativity. I'll say a bit more about gravitational waves later on. And of course, also for the detection of gravitational waves, there was a Nobel Prize in physics to Weiss, Barish, and Thorne in 2017. And as the last piece of evidence I want to invoke, this comes from the first images of black holes, resolving horizon scale structure by the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration. Maybe some members are in the audience, which I will tell you more about later. And this again corroborate the expectation from black holes in general relativity. On the other hand, on the theory side, GR predicts black holes. Moreover, there's a series of uniqueness theorems established for vacuum and the electrovacuum. together with some so-called no-hair theorems established for specific models that suggest that all astrophysical black holes, for all practical purposes, could be well described by the Kerr family of solutions of vacuum general relativity. This more specific version of the black hole hypothesis is often called the Kerr hypothesis. It's beautifully summarized by this Chandrasekhar quote, where he awes at the remarkable possibility that the Kerr solution provides the absolutely exact representation of untold numbers of massive black holes that populate the universe. So testing the Kerr and black hole hypothesis is to keep some critical skepticism about this statement and ask questions such as, are these untold numbers of massive black holes exactly represented by the Kerr metric? Or are these black holes all of the same type? Or still, are these objects really black holes? And today I want to focus on this third point and on the role of light rings. Now let me make the connection with light rings. For that, here's a nice image of the so-called shadow of a Kerr black hole with the spin axis pointing upwards with an idealized light source and seen from the equatorial plane. Let us analyze this a bit. For the Kerr solution, as well as for generic stationary and axisymmetric black hole solutions, both in vacuum, general relativity, and beyond, one can associate the edge of this black hole shadow, sometimes called the critical curve, to a set of photon-bound orbits, which we refer to as fundamental photon orbits here in this talk. Now, in the Schwarzschild case, all of these are the familiar planar light rings. So, of course, light can circumnavigate a black hole because of the extreme light bending. Here is a cartoon of the light ring orbit at r equals 3m in Schwarzschild and a spatial section of the horizon at r equals 2m. In the cartoon, this black region is the space-time trapped region, which is what defines a black hole. But the shadow is not the trapped region. Rather, it is a silhouette delimited by these fundamental photon orbits. So let me illustrate this for the general Kerr case. So in the Kerr case, the fundamental photon orbits are called spherical orbits since they have a constant radial Boyer-Lindquist coordinate. They are not planar anymore in general. As they go around the black hole, they can explore a range of latitudes. So to illustrate this, I show in the top right panel the shadow of a Kerr black hole, which as before has spin axis pointing up, seen from the equatorial plane, but now with a dimensionless spin parameter, which is only 82% of the maximum. These orbits are integrable and one can associate to each a number of conserved quantities. Then each point on the shadow edge can be associated to a photon with a certain impact parameter, eta, and the Carter constant Q. So one can identify the corresponding spherical orbit. Thus, the right equatorial point on the shadow's edge corresponds to the counter-rotating light ring, and you can see that on the left panel. The bottom right panel shows it has the largest perimetral radius, that's the dotted curve that you see there, and the vanishing angular amplitude in the latitudinal coordinate, theta. That's the black solid curve that I hope you can see in the plot. These two symmetric points, on the other hand, on the shadow's edge correspond to the green spherical orbit on the left panel, which does not reach the poles, explore some range of latitudes though. And these two symmetric points on the shadow's edge correspond to the blue spherical orbit on the left panel, which is the one spherical orbit that does reach the poles and has zero impact parameter. Moving on to positive impact parameters, these two symmetric points on the shadow's edge correspond to that red spherical orbit on the left panel, which again does not reach the poles, until finally we get to the left equatorial point on the shadow's edge corresponding to the co-rotating light ring, which is explicit in the left panel. The bottom right panel shows it has the smallest perimetral radius, that's the dotted curve, and again, a vanishing angular amplitude in the latitudinal coordinate, theta, it's planar again. Now, this sort of structure should be, in fact, rather universal, even for non-Kerr black hole models, where geodesic motion is not integral, even though in that case, some new features can arise, there might be some modifications. But in particular, black holes must have, in general, light rings. So a couple of years ago, together with Pedro Cunha, we've proved a theorem that establishes that a stationary, axisymmetric, asymptotically flat black hole in 1+3 dimensions with a non-extremal, topologically spherical Keeling horizon admits at least one standard light ring outside the horizon for each rotation sense. The proof uses no field equations and therefore is valid in generic theories of gravity. The theorem is based on a topological charge, which is going to be important in our discussion, and I will introduce it now. So the central idea is that light rings are critical points of a potential. The null geodesic flow on a stationary axisymmetric spacetime, assuming circularity, this is going to be important for us, is ruled by this Hamiltonian that you see here and you know, that can be split into a kinetic part and that corresponds to the non-Keeling directions and a potential part that corresponds to the Keeling directions. This potential U can be factorized using the conserved quantities, energy and angular momentum, so E and L, associated to the Keeling symmetries. And this introduces two other effective potentials I'm calling H plus and minus. They have the advantage of not depending on the conserved quantities anymore. The important thing, well, there was a glimpse of the explicit form, but that doesn't matter for these potentials. The important thing is that light rings are critical points of these potentials. And now one can associate a topological charge to light rings, and I will illustrate this for the Schwarzschild black hole case. So here are the two potentials for Schwarzschild. They only differ by a sign, and that is true for any spherical solution. One can then define a vector field as the gradient of each of these potentials. So for Schwarzschild, here is the representation of one of these vector fields in the R theta space. That's the non-Keeling space. So this is the space outside the black hole with the horizon towards the left, spatial infinity towards the right, and the top and bottom being the symmetry axis, theta equals zero and theta equals pi. The light ring is this point, R equals 3m, and on the equatorial plane. You can now imagine doing an arbitrary contour C that encloses the light ring. And you can consider the circulation of this vector field as you travel, say, anticlockwise around the contour. So here it is. I hope you can see, this is a little animation. So what you can see is that an anti-clockwise circulation of V around C gives a non-trivial clockwise winding. So let me show you this again. So you're going anti-clockwise around the contour, but there's this clockwise winding of the vector field. So this attributes a topological charge that I'm calling omega equals minus one to the light ring because the winding opposes the circulation. It does not matter what is the shape of the contour as long as it encloses the light ring. The result is the same. On the other hand, if you consider any contour C prime that does not enclose the light ring, one can observe the winding number of the vector field as it circulates around C prime is zero. So here it is, the same sort of cartoon. So you're now going again anticlockwise. It seems to start to wind around, but then it unwinds. So the winding number of V circulating around C prime is now omega equal to zero. In this pictorial description of the topological charge, you can observe that the only, only the direction of the vector field is actually relevant. So we can normalize it as in this figure here. Now all the arrows have the same size. Mathematically, the topological charge is defined via the integral, the angle of the vector field, which here I'm calling omega, makes with some reference direction, say the x-axis, as it circulates around the contour, which must be a multiple of 2 pi since the contour is closed and the multiplicity is the topological charge, omega. But not all light rings have a topological charge omega equals minus 1. Light rings are critical points of these H plus minus potentials. Now, a critical point can be a saddle point, a local minimum, or a local maximum. Standard light rings, like the ones in Schwarzschild or Kerr, are actually saddle points. For instance, in Schwarzschild, the light ring is unstable in the radial direction, but it is stable in the theta direction. They always have a topological charge omega equals minus 1. Exotic light rings, on the other hand, which are unlike the ones in Schwarzschild curve, are local minima or maxima. And they turn out to have a topological charge omega equals plus 1. Moreover, it is easy to show that the topological charge is additive. That is, if the contour encloses more than one light ring, then the contour integral is determined by the sum of the individual light ring charges, which can be minus 1 or plus 1. So here is an example. This is not a black hole. It's actually an exotic compact object, which possesses 2 light rings, an exotic one and a standard one. The exotic one is within the contour C1. And you can see, just following, say, with your finger, that as you go around clockwise, it winds clockwise, or if you go around anti-clockwise, it winds anti-clockwise. So it has a topological charge omega equals plus 1. And the latter, that is the standard one, is within contour C2, and it has, as we've seen, topological charge omega equals minus 1. You can also see that going around the overall contour, C3, the winding number is 0, which is, of course, plus 1 minus 1. Then to establish the theorem, we look at a contour C that, in the limit, encloses the whole space outside the horizon of a black hole. Imposing carefully boundary conditions, one can show that the total topological charge is omega equals minus 1. This does not use any field equations, just the boundary conditions of having an asymptotically flat black hole spacetime, regular on and outside, with the stated assumptions on the black hole. And this means that black holes must have at least one standard light ring. This works for each of the H plus minus potentials, so that means for each rotation sense. But this does not exclude black holes could have more than one light ring. But if so, the extra light rings must come in pairs, with one being exotic and the other an extra standard one, as to keep the total topological charge to be minus 1. In fact, there are known examples of black holes with these extra light rings.
Carlos?
Yeah.
In the assumption of the theorem, you're considering stationary black holes, or can it be general?
It's stationary and axisymmetric, and the metric is circular.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So the reason I have been talking about light rings to make now the connection is that they are closely connected to some of the strong gravity phenomenology of black holes, and therefore to their observational evidence that I've mentioned early on. I've already mentioned black hole shadows and this very academic image. Of course, you know that real life is rather more complicated. So in an astrophysical scenario, radiation in the vicinity of a black hole comes from synchrotron radiation, from an accretion disk or some astrophysical environment. And to model that, synthetic images are generated by GRMHD simulations like this one that was in the EHD papers, using a background metric, say the Kerr metric. Now, this image, which is from one of these simulations, shows a distinctive feature, which is this bright emission ring. Since we know the background metric, this feature can be interpreted, and it is essentially a lensed image of the black hole light ring. Then applying a Gaussian blurring filter to this synthetic image, to mimic real EHT observations. One obtains a synthetic blurred image that's on the right, which is quite similar to the real data that's on the left. And this serves to illustrate the observation is consistent with the Kerr black hole and that this emission ring is intimately connected to the light ring. Yeah, please go ahead.
Can you go back to that plot that you said that is the central figure, bottom? You're saying that that's the image of the photon, the light ring of the photosphere. I thought, I mean, I've been following this carefully, but I thought the photosphere contribution to the image, the synthetic image, is in the few percent. Here it's just everything. It's the ring. Are you sure that that ring is the lens manifestation of the photosphere?
With an offset of a few percent.
Okay, so then... Yeah.
With an offset of a few percent. Yeah, that's what it's claimed actually in the papers. Yeah. As far as that.
Right.
What's that?
People like Sam Grada disputed this claim very strongly.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. Yeah, I have nothing to add to that discussion. I think that the claim here is that there's an association between the light ring and this emission ring. And actually, this is used by the EHT to infer the properties of the black hole. In the first paper, they calculated there's an offset of 10%. And with that, they calculated how you relate the size then with the mass of the black hole. In the second paper, they don't say the number, 10%, but a few percent. But they give actually the numbers of what is the diameter of the measured emission ring and the corresponding diameter that they estimate for the mass of the black hole, what would be the light ring in that case. I don't want to get into that discussion. What I can say is that, and this is my point here, that there's been an association between the light ring and observation features. So that's my point. Exactly the details of that have been disputed by Sam Grala, as you know, but yeah, I have nothing to add to that.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Right, so another connection which people have put forward, which is again not completely generic, I believe, is that they play a role, light rings in gravitational wave observations. So for the events where one can see the merger, part of the signal is the ring down. It turns out that this ring down has a close connection to light rings, at least in some cases. And this can be seen in the Iconal approximation, where it has been shown that for spherical black holes, the real part of the frequency of quasi-normal modes is associated to the frequency of null geodesics traveling on the light ring. And this is this omega C that is in this formula. Whereas the imaginary part is associated to the Lyapunov exponent, lambda, which is measuring the instability of that orbit. The connection for general black holes is more complicated. I believe this is still under discussion. Nonetheless, this connection between ring down and light rings was used to hypothesize that horizonless ultra-compact echoes, where here ultra-compact means they have similar light rings to black holes, could vibrate similarly to black holes when perturbed, at least initially, even though some echoes in the signal should in general be present if there is no fully absorbing event horizon. And this is my motivation. These connections between light rings and observables, the bright emission ring, shadow, the ring down, have triggered an immense interest on these ultra-compact echoes. The question raised is how much does the data favor the black hole hypothesis against this more speculative echo hypothesis? Or in particular, if black hole mimickers with similar light rings to those of black holes, but no event horizon, if they could be contenders to explain the data. So this leads me to the echo hypothesis. Echoes have the appeal that they could avoid the singularity problem. and perhaps connect to another fundamental problem of modern physics, which is that of dark matter. Actually, many echoes, and not necessarily with light rings, have been proposed throughout the years in different guises, sometimes also with different motivations, not always to replace black holes. Some kind of compromise introducing new players that could coexist with black holes. If any of these or other models, and I apologize if in the list is not your favorite model, should be taken seriously in the long run, amounts probably to two questions. Can they explain the observations? And are they good theoretically? So many of these models are admittedly very exotic, but so were black holes once. I've listed here a bunch of examples, but ideally we would like to make general statements about this object. So let me show you how one can make one such general statement. So some time ago, together with Pedro and Emanuele Berti, we got another theorem that applies very generically to ultra-compact echoes that can form from smooth initial data on Minkowski spacetime through an incomplete gravitational collapse. And by this, I mean no horizon forms. The theorem states that axisymmetric stationary solutions of the Einstein field equations formed from classical gravitational collapse obeying the null energy condition that are everywhere smooth and ultra compact must have at least two light rings, and one of them is stable. In fact, the theorem applies a bit more generically than in GR, as I will explain. And the proof of this theorem is again based on the topological charge. The idea is exactly the same as in the black hole case, but now instead of horizon boundary condition, one has a regular origin as a boundary condition. And this actually changes the direction of the vector field at that end and implies that now the total topological charge must be zero. The result only depends on boundary conditions and smoothness up to this point. No field equations were assumed. And it applies obviously to flat spacetime. And the corollary is that for any ultra-compact echo that is smoothly deformable into flat spacetime, light rings, if they are present, come in pairs with one exotic and another standard one forming together. The nice thing is that this can be converted into a dynamical picture. If one starts with dilute initial data, meaning it's not deforming very much Minkowski spacetime like an ordinary star, there are no light rings and hence the topological charge is zero. Whatever happens in the dynamical collapse, it's not so important as long as it is smooth. No topology changes are allowed. We then assume that the final stage, an equilibrium horizonless ultra-compact echo, is stationary and axisymmetric. Then its topological charge must be zero. And this is clear because one could connect the final ultra-compact echo to flat spacetime by an off-shell sequence of smoothly deformed spacetimes, where the topological charge is defined all along. Note that the true dynamical process, which is certainly not stationary, needs not be axisymmetric, as expected actually in a realistic process. And then the punchline is that any stationary, axisymmetric, circular, topologically trivial echo that forms from an incomplete gravitational collapse, which has a standard light ring, must have an exotic one as well. So at this moment, it remains to clarify the type of the exotic light ring.
Carlos,
yes.
Your answer. So where would the exotic light ring would be outside? So I guess the motivation I have here is, so you're probably familiar with these ABS black bubbles. So these are objects that are satisfy, I think, all the requirements that you put, except that maybe inside you have an anti-negative cosmological constant and you might not like that.
Well, it changes the boundary condition. That's fundamental, the ADS, because here it's asymmetrically flat. Yeah.
All the way in. I mean, it's a gravastar well defined. So you have a negative cosmological constant inside. Outside, the radius, the Buchdahl radius is Schwarzschild, so you would have one light ring there. Where would the other be? Or what is not consistent with your theorem?
Well, if it's smooth, it must be. So there's some kind of, in the gravistars, you have to connect the two spacetimes, right?
But it's smooth. I mean, you engineer it to be smooth.
So usually.
Well, I'm not sure about how smooth it is. If it is smooth, then this will hold. That is, and from our experience, whatever cases we've seen, the stable light ring is always inside the unstable one. It does. The question about inside or outside is a bit meaningless. Say in boson stars, everything is inside because matter only goes away at infinity. But yeah.
Okay.
Carlos, I have a related question.
Please.
I'm trying to understand the theorem, and as far as I can see from what you talked about so far, so the vector field is a construction that relies on a stationary spacetime. You start with a stationary spacetime, and then you define your potentials, then you define your gradient field, and that's your vector field. So correct. If the vector field is not defined during a dynamical stage, how can you guarantee that topologically it's going to stay the same?
Right. So this was my point a bit about this off-shell kind of sequence of spacetimes. So I have that initially and finally. So the theorem only applies to stationary and axisymmetric, right? So it could be that in the meantime, in the dynamical process, axisymmetry is lost. But my final compact object has to be axisymmetric. What I am saying is that then I could connect, and let me put the figure here, the initial spacetime, which is axisymmetric, and the final spacetime, which is axisymmetric, by a sequence of deformed spacetimes, which all of them are axisymmetric. So along this sequence, I can define my topological charge all along. And since it's a smooth deformation, then the topological charge must be the same in the beginning and in the end. So that was my cartoon here, this bottom part here. That's the off-shell sequence where the sequence of spacetimes, all of them would be axisymmetric.
But they also have to be stationary. So it would be a stationary sequence that sort of mimics the dynamic,
exactly, quasi-diabatic kind of sequence that would mimic the interpolation between the final state and the initial state. It doesn't need to solve any equations of motion, any of them. I'm just advocating that this allows me to show that the topological charge must be the same in the beginning and at the end.
Okay, so that's an idea that I think I would have to think about. I mean, it's not obvious to me that, I mean, I understand the construction. I'd have to think about it. But thank you.
Thank you very much for your question. Thank you. So what I was trying to argue is that we will have two light rings if it is ultra compact, our echo, under our assumptions, and one of them is exotic. Now I'll try to argue that the exotic one has to be stable. So for that, we consider the null vector, p mu, which is tangent to this exotic light ring. So under our assumptions for the metric, we can show in full generality that at the light ring, the Einstein tensor contracted with this null vector twice is the Laplacian in the r theta space of the potential that determines light rings. So these potential light rings are also critical points of this potential. And then assuming now for the first time, the Einstein field equations, so we are in GR, a similar statement holds in terms of the energy momentum tensor. So it follows that if the light ring is a local maximum of U, then the neck, the null energy condition is violated. Conversely, if one imposes the null energy condition, the exotic one must be fully stable. So let me remark that in modified gravity, we could proceed in a similar way in terms of an effective energy momentum tensor. So putting everything else in the generalized Einstein equations rather than the Einstein tensor to the right-hand side and calling it an energy momentum tensor, an effective. And this leads us to the issue of the light ring instability. Perhaps this is where the crack is. So it was suggested that stable light rings could trigger a space-time instability. It's an intuitive picture that a potential well for null perturbations, and this is not just electromagnetic, gravitational well, of course, they may such a well may lead them to pile up there so that eventually they will deform space-time. The issue is how any relaxation mechanism competes with this piling up. This was investigated by Joe Kerr in this paper, who used a toy model to suggest that the relaxation mechanism is not efficient. So individual modes decay, but not sufficiently fast. Then the instability triggered is nonlinear. That is, it's not caused by a single mode, it's this piling up that leads to a non-trivial back reaction. In any case, this would mean that one cannot check the instability by a perturbative analysis. Moreover, and crucially, these arguments tell us nothing about the timescale of the instability. If the instability is present, but it takes too long to develop, it could be harmless in practice. So at this point, we can only say that the existence of a stable light ring is a potentially generic obstruction for any ultra-compact echo that can form from classical GR dynamics, with exotic, but still decent in the sense of neck matter. Of course, if one agrees to violate the null energy condition, one needs not have a stable light ring, but then Penrose's theorem doesn't follow either, and one needs not have singularities inside black holes.
So, Carlos?
Yes, please.
Can you say a bit more about why this log behavior in time suggests that there is a nonlinear instability?
Right. So what I understand from the paper of Joe Kerr, he actually does a linear computation. He calculates the wave equation, scalar wave equation, on the background with stable light rings, or some assumes the existence of this. And he can show that there is a decay, but this decay goes as 1 over the log of some time coordinates. And then in order to have dissipation like occurs in flat space-time, you'd have to have 1 over a power of this time coordinate. So the log makes that this decay is very slow. Still, individual modes decay. So the argument is, well, it's not a single mode that is growing because modes decay, but the relaxation, if you put many modes there, will not be fast enough. And therefore, the instability is nonlinear. That's the sense in which I understand instability is nonlinear.
Sorry, but why does this mean there is an instability? So it doesn't decay fast enough, but why does that mean it has to be an instability?
Well, because you'll be piling up a lot of energy in a certain place and eventually it should back react on space-time. It doesn't dissipate.
Disperse.
It doesn't disperse. Fast
so
enough.
That has to lead to an instability because you have some energy that's not decaying fast enough in a space-time region. So that
I don't think it has to. It's just suggestive.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, this is something I never understand. I mean, it's for me, it's something like instability can happen, but I just don't see a very strong argument why it has to happen.
Right, I took this as a suggestion as well. So we would like to test it. That's the whole point of our work.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so then, for quite a few years, we've been looking for a good testing ground for this putative light ring instability. And a good testing ground would be some echo model, which is free of other instabilities, perturbative instabilities, an ergo region instability, as to isolate the light ring instability as the only possible issue. And two, the echo model should be dynamically robust, thus prone to nonlinear evolutions. So luckily there is around a good family of echo models, which are bosonic stars. So bosonic stars are lumps of bosonic fields, scalar or vector. They are self-gravitating. They can be quite compact and thus become interesting black hole mimickers. And let me tell you some facts about bosonic stars and set against the checklist of theoretical criteria that any reasonable echo model or even a non-curved black hole model should obey. So first, bosonic stars appear in a well-motivated and consistent physical model that's GR minimally coupled to massive bosonic fields, scalar or vector, which need not have, but can have self-interactions, at least in some circumstances. So it is GR with, again, some decent matter. Second, bosonic stars have a dynamical formation mechanism, which is gravitational cooling that was advocated and found by Seidel and Swen back in the 1990s. And finally, bosonic stars are stable against perturbative instabilities in some models and some regions of the parameter space. Now, this does not mean issues are absent, and we are still discovering as we go along subtle problems in some models. For instance, 3 years ago, we found that scalar rotating mini boson stars, which means without any self-interactions, are unstable. And I'll say more about that. As another example, more recently, it was found that the initial value problem can become ill-defined for self-interacting Broca fields. So again, for some time, we were looking for bosonic star models where light rings emerge and no other instabilities are present. But this is not so easy. The simplest spherical models don't work. So these bosonic stars are in general determined by a frequency parameter because the bosonic field has a harmonic time dependence, which vanishes at the level of the energy momentum tensor, and they are truly stationary or static as a metric. So this is the star's mass in the vertical versus frequency in the horizontal for the simplest models. You should consider the red curve, that's for the mass. The left panel is for the scalar case and the right panel is for the vector case. It's well known that the stable branch occurs between the Newtonian limit, that's for the largest frequencies, and the maximum of the ADM mass. So this is the maximum of the ADM mass. And these are the stable branches. This is suggested by generic so-called turning point arguments that imply that bosonic stars change their stability when an extremum of the mass as a function of an appropriate parameter is achieved. But for these spherical stars, this has been confirmed by explicit perturbative computations. On the other hand, light rings only merge well within the unstable branches. Actually, in the third unstable branch, well, in the third branch for the scalar case and the fourth branch for the Broca case, and the insets show a zoom of those branches. And the picture that light rings only merge well within the unstable branches in spherical boson stars or bosonic stars seem to be more general, even in models with self-interactions, as we've tested in this paper quoted at the bottom of the slide. So here we show what actually happens to these ultra-compact spherical bosonic stars without self-interactions. So evolving them using numerical relativity techniques, even in spherical symmetry, and just with the perturbation seeded from numerical truncation error, they collapse to black holes in just a few tens of light crossing times. So you can see the apparent horizon mass increasing and the bosonic field energy decreasing in these plots. And that's for the scalar case on the left and the vector case on the right. But let me remark, one cannot attribute this to collapse to light rings, since solutions in the unstable branch without light rings can also collapse similarly to black holes. And by the way, light rings do emerge in pairs in all of these and other bosonic star models in accordance to the theorem. So we started looking for our testing ground for the light ring instability using spinning bosonic stars. However, we had found in 2019 that the most fundamental spinning scalar boson stars without any self-interactions develop a non-axisymmetric instability at a moderately long time scale of the order of 1,000 light crossing times. And you can see it in this visualization of the fully nonlinear evolution of the Einstein-Klein-Gordon system in the left panel. Here, the color code denotes the scalar field amplitude. And so I'll put it again. When the non-axisymmetric instability kicks in, an apparent horizon forms, as you can see in the right panel, where the mass associated to this apparent horizon is this blue solid line. And the energy associated with the scalar field is the green dashed line, which tends to vanish as it's swallowed by the black hole. This is all signaling a formation of a black hole. So these stars collapse into a black hole. And this has nothing to do with light rings, as these stars are not ultra-compact. And by the way, this instability occurs where, by turning point arguments, one would expect a stable branch of solutions, showing these arguments are indicative only. One has to take them with some care. However, the instability was not seen in the Cousin-Broca model. At least this is what we could be deduced from numerical simulations with a timescale 10 times larger than the ones where the scalar instability is seen. So at the time, we suggested this difference in dynamical stability could be associated to the different morphology of these stars. The scalar stars are toroidal, whereas the vector stars are spheroidal. There's an analogy with models of rotating neutron stars where toroidal solutions are possible, but suffer in general a similar instability. Well, likely things are more complicated and people have seen things to be more complicated afterwards. But we then started to understand that this non-axisymmetric instability in the scalar case could be mitigated by adding self-interactions. That was the paper. And then this work by East and Simonson suggested that the instability of the scalar stars could actually be completely quenched by appropriate self-interactions. So this led us to identify some appropriate models for testing the light ring instability. And for concreteness, let me show you a couple of Lagrangians. One is the scalar model with self-interactions. These ones here, they are often called, it's often called the solitonic model. It contains two disconnected branches that, by the generic turning point arguments, are potentially stable. One of each corresponds to quite compact solutions. It's called the relativistic stable branch. And the other model is the vector model, also known as the Broca model, without self-interactions, which, as I have already mentioned, exhibited no noticeable instabilities in previous analysis. So this overall picture is summarized in this plot showing the solution space in both models. Consider first the inset, which shows the domain of existence of the scalar solitonic model. This potentially relativistic stable branch against a perturbative instability is from the local minimum, which is here, until the absolute maximum, which is there. This is just based on the turning point, the generic turning point arguments. What Simonson and East checked is that some of the solutions at the bottom of this branch still suffer from a non-axisymmetric instability, but that shuts off for solutions below the frequency of about 0.493, which is around here. So the evidence is that from this point down in frequency to the maximal mass, we have a relativistic stable branch. The first solution with light rings is where this pink diamond sits, here. Then the dashed line would be a set of ultra-compact Bosut stars within this putative stable branch. And importantly, an ergo region only appears at this blue star. So the ultra-compact stars along the dashed line are free from an ergo region instability. A very analogous picture holds for Broca model, which is now the main panel. Again, the first solution with light rings is where the pink diamond sits, which is here, and the dashed line is the set of ultra-compact Broca stars within the stable branch, at least against linear perturbations. This set is now determined by the emergency of the ergo region, which appears at the blue star, so there. So the two sets of solutions corresponding to these dashed lines are our testing ground for the light ring instability. For reference, I put here the frequency interval for the dashed lines for both cases. So now the strategy was, let's perform again fully nonlinear numerical relativity evolutions using these stars in these intervals as initial data, as well as some outside for benchmarking. And this uses the machinery of numerical relativity that we developed in previous works, namely these papers here, led by Nico Sanchez-Gual and Miguel Zillon. And in this plot, I'm already showing the timescale of the instability versus the frequency. So I'm anticipating the result. And to benchmark, let us first analyze a non-ultra-compact solution, a Broca star, without light rings and has the frequency 0.72. So it's outside the ultra-compact regime. I'll show you some movies now. The evolution of a non-ultra-compact spinning Proca star with 072 is seen here. It shows the energy density of the star with the color code that you see there. The evolution shows some small oscillations. These are typically of these numerical evolutions. There's no sign of instability. Note that at the edge, the oscillations look large, but notice the scale. So this is a log scale. They are very small numbers. And one can safely say these oscillations go away with increasing resolution and grid size. If we now move to the ultra-compact regime, the picture changes. And we've done this for various solutions, but I'll just show you an illustrative case. So that's with frequency 068, that's over there. Then, so I'll start the movie. At a time, which in this case is of order of 800 in our units, the star develops an instability. So I'll put it again. That first mildly and at times more notoriously destroys its axis symmetry without destroying the star though. The star is losing part of its energy and angular momentum, I'll show you that. And mostly it's carried by the ejected Broca field, very little by gravitational waves. And it also suffers a kick. It's moving away from the grid center. In fact, it seems to be pushed around a bit like a full balloon, which is emptying its air and going everywhere. I will come back to this very shortly, but let us first analyze the scalar case. Now, for frequencies greater than 0.188, so inside the relativistic stable branch, but in the vicinity of the ultra-compact stars, we do not see any stability or development. Actually, Simonsen and East did that also for precisely this model, and the frequency, which in their paper was 0.303, so non-ultra-compact, fairly close to the ultra-compact region, and reported no sign of instability when evolving for a time of about 7,000 in units of mass. Now, in the interval under consideration, where they are ultra-compact, on the other hand, we always see collapse into a black hole. So here's the case with frequency 0.16, which is the star, the blue star in the plot. So we show the evolution here. First one sees at some point a breakdown of the axis symmetry, and very, very fast, the star collapses, it disappears. As it disappears, we can find an apparent horizon showing black hole formation. And this is diagnosed by the minimum of the lapse as usual, N, which goes to zero at horizon formation. And here you can also see the time evolution of the scalar field energy and the black hole mass. So at this point, we were pretty confident about two conclusions. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but I had a couple of questions on the previous part of the time instability.
Yeah.
Going back one more.
Yeah. This one?
No, the one where you had the instability time as a function of, yeah, that one, thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, so I guess a couple of questions. So for all these cases, are you just seeding with truncation error? And this is
right.
This instability is the time it takes to see some like large change in your star. Is that right?
That's correct.
So would that then means that as you increase the resolution, you expect this T instability to become arbitrarily large as you defined it, right?
I didn't quite get that. So if I increase the resolution, you expect the instability to become arbitrarily large? That's what you said?
I'm saying if you're just seeding by truncation error, that sets the initial amplitude of some perturbation, and then that perturbation grows with some fixed time scale. And as you increase the resolution and seed the instability at smaller and smaller amplitudes, then you expect this T instability as you've defined it to become larger and larger. Like, so this is kind of a resolution dependent quantity that you've defined here. Is that right?
Well, what I can tell you about resolution is that if you use a very low resolution, you might miss the instability because there's always a drift in the quantities and we see the mass and angular momentum going down. So what we've checked is that we need sufficiently high resolution to have something steady and then we can start to see this behavior that I've showed you. We cannot go to arbitrarily large resolutions.
Yeah, sure. But for example, if you double the resolution, how does T instability change?
I can show you at the end, perhaps not to interrupt. I have some backup plots and I could show you one. Is that okay?
Sure.
Or would you like to see it? Because it's at the end of my presentation. But yeah, so in some cases, actually double say the resolution and we would see the instability for both resolutions. So there would be a lower one where we would see a very large drift and we didn't see the instability, then we increase. And we have at some point the instability rising and the highest resolution as well. If the instability takes too long to develop, we couldn't run the simulation with the highest resolution or the resolution that we see it and still a higher one. So I can show you a case in which we see the instability in two different resolutions.
Yeah, I guess my question is more like, what's the physical interpretation of this T instability? Because like, for example, if you, had a linear instability, then you wait till the time it grows to become nonlinear, and you're just seeing it by truncation, or if you double the resolution, you expect the initial amplitude to go down by, two by whatever your convergence order is, and then you expect that many more equal lengths of time until the instability goes unstable. So if you're just checking the time for the thing to go nonlinear, this T instability seems dependent on resolution. If instead you just measure the e-folding time of the linear instability, that's like a physical quantity that doesn't depend on resolution. So I guess my question is this T instability, should we guess associate that with some physical time associated with the instability, or is that just sort of dependent on the numerical resolution?
I don't think it is that dependent on the numerical resolution, but we could not associate it to anything like the e-folding time of a given mold. If this is a non-linear instability, that's a good reason. We've tried several things looking at the potential well, looking at modes related to how light can be trapped within this potential well. We couldn't see any particular feature that from that analysis would translate to the time at which we are seeing the instability being triggered. Maybe that's some supporting the fact that this is something nonlinear and it's hard to come up with what is the time of the instability by any simple analysis. I'm sorry, but I cannot say much more than that.
Okay, yeah, maybe we could talk more then. But maybe just one quick question on this plot. So here you have these like smooth curves as a function of omega. So did you like really study sort of systematically all the values of omega to fill this in?
Well, we did a few values. I mean, I could show you a broken curve. Honestly, I mean, we just put it like this to seem better. We don't have only three. I can tell you how many values we have. I think that, for instance, the point at which you see, there is an upper limit to the time of the simulation. So the point at the top is simply because we didn't see any instability, so it will have to be. And then we have like I believe something like 6 or 7 points. So there's a broken line, but we could see clearly this feature which we do not know honestly the interpretation, but we see it apparently in both cases. It's not monotonically growing with the frequency. That's something that would be nice to understand better. Actually, it's in my list of questions. We don't have like 1,000 points there, if that's your question, no.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so I think that I'm running out of time, but I hope that you will allow me to finish my talk because there's been a lot of questions. How am I doing with time?
Can you just-
I need something like more. Maybe 10 minutes, 5-10 minutes, is that okay?
Yes, I think that's fine, yeah.
Okay, so thank you. Right, so I think that I was somewhere here and I was telling you that at this point we were pretty confident about two conclusions. First, that the light ring instability occurs. Well, the examples we studied show a clear transition in the behavior between the solutions with and without light rings along what could be expected to be a set of solutions with similar stability properties. Even if previous results shows that there is a non-axisymmetric instability in the scalar case, for sufficiently high frequency along that branch, I will argue in a little bit that that instability that was seen by East and Simonson is different in nature to what is occurring for these ultra compact solutions. And second, its time scale is astrophysically, if you'd like, short, except if close to this critical solution where we only see that this curve is growing. Moreover, the fate of the light ring instability for the solid tonic scalar stars was also clear. They collapse to a black hole, but it remained to clarify what was the fate in the Proca case. I will now argue that it is a migration towards towards non-ultra-compact stars or solutions. So the first piece of evidence is the time evolution of the mass and angular momentum. Here shown for four spinning Proca stars, three have light rings, and these are the ones with 0.68, 69, and 70, and one does not, the one with 0.72. And the mass and angular momentum of the critical model, which is separating ultra-compact from non-ultra-compact solutions, is given by the solid and dashed black line. So I'm putting it here for reference. The models with light ring suffer, as you can see, an important loss of angular momentum when this instability kicks in. It's more or less clear what's the time at which we can say the instability kicks in. And there are these strong oscillations, as you can see, say, in the red line at the top. Afterwards, they lose angular momentum and mass at a slower rate and tending towards values corresponding to configurations without light rings. On the other hand, as expected, the model with 0.72 does not show any instability. But we wanted to see this migration more from the viewpoint of the light rings themselves. So to show you a second piece of evidence, in our paper, we introduced a technique which is called an adiabatic effective potential. And this allowed introducing an effective potential for null geodesics, even in an evolving spacetime, as long as the evolution is sufficiently slow in an appropriate sense, and the deviations from axis symmetry are mild. So here you see the effective potential given by the solid red line. This is gonna be a movie, so you'll see it moving. And this is for the evolution of the Proca star that I've shown you the movie of, the one with the frequency 0.68. So the maximum is the standard light ring, the minimum is the exotic one. Simultaneously, you see the corresponding effective potential for null geodesics for a sequence of stationary solutions. So these are the dashed lines 1 to 5. All of these are ultra compact and have light rings, and they correspond to the extreme of the potential. As time evolves, we shall see that the adiabatic potential is oscillating, sometimes violently. So we also average it over an oscillation period of the lapse, which is taken to represent the physical oscillations of the evolving star. This is gonna be the dashed red line. So after all of this, so here's the movie. So after some initial adjustment, the star, well, the stability has not kicked in yet, and at some point it will, and this adiabatic effective potential is starting to oscillate. The average one is the dashed line, it oscillates less. So there are some strong oscillations. Sometimes it seems to dig some deeper potential, but it doesn't collapse. And then there are oscillations, but there is a clear trend, and it's better seen if you look at the average potential. And what you can see is that there is a trend in which the solution is fairly close to equilibrium solutions, and the trend is tending to make it less and less ultra-compact in the direction of the critical solution, which is the first where light rings are created. So the question here was, but does this process take an infinite amount of time, or is it a finite amount of time? And remember that while doing this, the star is going around in the grid, so it had to define these quantities with respect to the center of the star and not the center of the grid. So these, if you look at the average potential, it's going to approach quite a lot, well, quite closely, the solution one. You cannot tell from this plot, but in fact, the two extrema will disappear And then they can reappear again. There can be oscillations in which the two light rings will reappear and then disappear again. So the first disappearance of the two light rings when they merge is about 7,500. And this is the end of the simulation. And you can see it more quantitatively here. So this is the evolution of the light ring circumferential radius computed from the adiabatic average potential. That's in red. The blue line is an interpolation to help see the pattern. And one can clearly see the light rings converge, and the first convergence occurs at about 7,500. It's not here, but Pedro that did this analysis, he saw the light rings appearing again and then merging again, like a creation of particle into particle and annihilation. And there were a couple of cycles of that with smaller amplitude. But the trend seems clear. Now, an obvious question, and I'm almost done, is why the difference in outcome between the scalar and the vector case? Well, one observation relates to compactness that you see plotted here. The scalar stars have, that we've analyzed are more compact than the vector ones. For instance, the scalar star I showed you collapsed into a black hole with frequency 0.16 has a compactness of about 0.33, whereas the vector star that I showed you migrate has a compactness 0.19. And my final slide before the conclusions, another important question, and I promise to come back to this, is the two non-axisymmetric instabilities in the scalar relativistic stable branch, which we believe are quite different. And we believe this is related to energetics. So here I'm showing you again the domain of existence of the scalar solitonic stars, highlighting not only the ultra-compact stars, that's the black dashed line, where we have seen collapse, but also the region where one also sees a non-axisymmetric instability as a blue dashed line. So there are several differences. The first one is the outcome. You see, whereas the ultra-compact stars collapse into a black hole, for the solutions in this dashed blue line, Will and Simonson showed the outcome was fragmentation into two non-spinning boson stars that are ejected at high speed. And they suggested this outcome is related to energetics. So along this blue dashed line, it is energetically favorable for the spinning star to decay into non-spinning stars with half the Noether charge of the former each. This is not the case for the ultra-compact stars. They are not energetically unstable in this sense. Additionally, the strength of the ultra-compact instability roughly increases with decreasing omega, whereas it decreases with decreasing omega for the fragmentation instability. So despite both being a non-axisymmetric instability, we believe evidence supports the two instabilities have a different source and a different outcome. So let me conclude, give you some final thoughts. To the question, can there be ultra-compact echoes? Well, according to this analysis, it might seem hard because this analysis supports the light ring instability to be real, and it needs not to be long-lived except near the critical solution, where one can debate if they can still mimic black holes. That's an interesting question, leading at least to two fates, the collapse and the migration. This questions perhaps the plausibility of ultra-compact echoes that have a plausible formation mechanism within GR. But these are just a couple of families of examples. Even if you believe everything we have done, are we missing some generality? There are some details in the analysis for which a deeper understanding would be nice. I've listed some there. And one can also ask if there are reasonable ultra-compact echoes without a stable light ring by dropping some of the assumptions. And I've listed some there as well. And one can also ask the extent to which echoes can mimic black holes if they are not ultra-compact. And that's an interesting question. And there are some, I would say, very sharp examples that are worth considering. In any case, I think that I've said everything. I would like to thank you for your patience and your attention. Thank you very much.
Yeah, let's send you. Any questions from the online Adin. Oh, any questions from people in the room? Yeah. Thanks, Carlos, for an interesting talk.
Thank you.
Yeah, so maybe one question I had is, this question of if you're seeing nonlinear instability or not. So did you try to, look at some quantity that's growing and then, compare its growth rate to amplitude? Like if it's linear instability, expect the growth rate to be proportional to amplitude. And if it's like, a nonlinear, it might go like the square of the amplitude or some higher power or something like that. So I mean, do you have like sort of a weekly nonlinear phase where you can look at quantities like that and measure some time scale associated with the growth?
Well, the short answer is no, at least we haven't identified anything that could be a kind of a mold growing. And I don't think we could identify anything related to what we know from a linear instability. So like you do in your paper, for instance.
Sorry.
Please go ahead.
Even if it's nonlinear, like you could see that the the growth rate is proportional to the square of the amplitude or something like that.
Yeah, no, we haven't really matched these things. No, we haven't. We haven't tried. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe Nico, if he's around, are you around, Nico, if you'd like to say something? I mean, as far as I remember our discussions, we didn't. So Nico did the simulation. So perhaps if he has something to say.
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Hi, Nico.
Yes, so I mean, we tried to find in a quantity where that was growing with time, but I mean, we couldn't really find anything related to the Broca field or the scalar field or to the space-time that was really growing. I mean, it was, you see like the drop in the angular momentum in the mass, like this losing part of it, and you see like the morphology changes from axis symmetry to non-axis symmetry, but it's not really like in the mini boson stars, where we study the different modes of the energy density, and we saw the growth there. I mean, we did that in this case, and we didn't see that growth.
Okay, thanks.
I guess I'm a bit confused about this. So, in the movie you showed about the Scala boson star, like initially it was just kind of flat energy density inside the star. But then just before the collapse, there were like high M perturbations. So why can't you just track those as a function of time? Like if you go back to the...
I know what you're saying. Yes, there are modes and there's a clear dominating mode. Yes. So what you're saying is that you'd like to see how that particular mode is growing as a function of time. Well, we can do that, but I don't know if Nico tried to do this, but this is happening precisely when the instability is kicking in. So what is your point? What would you like to see from that mode? So because the time scale for the instability is not counting just from the growth of that mode. That's not apparently growing from the very beginning. It grows at some point very fast, it's seen, and then the star collapse. So maybe I'm missing what you're trying to say.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that initially you have no mode, and then at some point something happens, right? And it might be worth tracking the thing that happens and try to track it as early as possible to figure out maybe something is happening before you see it in the energy density. Like before it's like an order one fraction of the perturbation. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you're saying, yes.
Right.
But at the moment, I don't think we did it. I think we should look at this more carefully, perhaps. I think that most of what we concluded or, was somehow also biased by the fact that we were from the beginning thinking this is something nonlinear. We shouldn't be looking at individual modes, but yeah, perhaps we should try to see as much as we can about the individual modes that are, and there are some individual M modes that are being excited that one can see just from the symmetries of the problem. That's true. Yeah, so I don't have much more to say about this. I don't know, Nico, if you'd like to say something about it, please go ahead.
Yes, yeah, I think it's something that we could do to track this, the growth of the modes. Yeah, so thank you for the suggestion.
Yeah, thank you.
Right, and then a second thing. So these Proca stars you showed in the movie started moving around. So did you guys check that was like lots of linear momentum being radiated, or where does this movement come from?
Right, it comes from an isotropy in the emission of the Proca field. So I think I've said that we see very little gravitational wave emission. So it's more like it's ejecting part of the mass and the angular momentum, and it's not doing it in an isotropic way. And that is the reason why there is a kick.
Right, but then there's like several different kicks supposedly. So where does this break of the symmetry come from? Like first you send like waves in one direction, and then suddenly you send waves in a different direction. You're breaking some symmetry there. I don't know where this breaking comes from.
Right, because as you've said, I mean, you develop some non-axisymmetric modes, and this is breaking the axisymmetry, and that affects the emission of the mass loss, if you'd like, and angular momentum loss.
Right, but I kind of picture that more as a gradual process, or like at least one process, but you seem to say that it's like one process in one direction, and then suddenly it switches direction. It just seems a bit odd.
Correct. In the movie, we can see two clear changes of direction. So it seems that at some point there is a strong effect, a strong different anisotropy. Yeah. So initially there is somehow an anisotropy, and there is a preferred ejection in one direction, which perhaps then it's more or less isotropic. And then eventually there is a second kick in a different direction. We do see these cycles with strong oscillations in the angular momentum. So yeah, there seems to be cycles in which the star is actually not only ejecting material, but also some of the material comes back to the star. So what I can say is that it seems to be a complicated dynamics, but the basic idea is what you've said. So there's this anisotropy, or what I've said, if there's this anisotropic emission. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Oh, if not, let's thank Carlos again.